Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Wayne and Pike counties aren't feeling it yet. The Pennsylvania state budget is still delayed, and we'll hear from River reporters Liam Mayo on what this means for schools, social services, and you in Northeast Pennsylvania coming up. Karen Russell takes the reins at New Hope Community 30 years in, ready to lead and challenging how we see disability. We'll meet the new CEO. 10 years, a dedicated state budget, and a bolder vision for the Catskills. The leaders of the Catskill Center reflect on a decade that's reshaped the preserve and its communities on the latest episode of Cats Cast. And visionary singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Phoebe Legere. We'll talk to her about her new film and single at the Phoenicia Playhouse. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Stocks on Wall Street are trading mixed this morning as President Trump escalates his pressure campaign against the Federal Reserve. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 5 points right now.
President Trump says he's firing Fed Governor Lisa Cook after allegations from a Trump ally that Cook made false statements on a mortgage application. Cook says Trump has no authority to fire her, and she vows to continue serving on the Fed's governing board. By law, the central bank is supposed to operate free from White House pressure, but Trump has been outspoken in demanding the Fed lower interest rates. If he succeeds in removing Cook, Trump would have a chance to name a majority of the Fed's 7-member board. New orders for long-lasting manufactured goods fell in July for the third time in 4 months, dragged down by a drop in commercial aircraft orders. That could turn around, though. A Korean airline just announced an order for more than 100 Boeing jets. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is once again taking aim at the mainstream media. In a series of posts on social media Sunday, Trump reiterated his push for the FCC to revoke the broadcast licenses of ABC and NBC. NPR's David Folkenflik reports the agency's chairman is already investigating nearly all of the major news networks.
You're seeing the FCC, which has historically been operated as a semi-autonomous agency that is not as part of the command control structure of the executive branch and the president, really operate in line with the president's political agenda and also his personal agenda.
That's NPR's David Folkenflik reporting. National news networks don't have broadcast licenses, but local affiliates do. SpaceX says it will try again tonight to launch its massive Starship rocket. It will be its 10th test flight. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports cloudy weather in Texas forced the company to cancel last night's attempt.
SpaceX had tried to send up the approximately 400-foot-tall two-stage rocket on Sunday night, but a line that fed oxygen into the rocket was leaking and had to be fixed. On their second opportunity to launch from the SpaceX facility in South Texas, they fueled up Starship and the count went all the way down to T-minus 40 seconds. This time, though, the trouble was anvil clouds. These thunderstorm clouds were too close to the launch pad, so the attempt had to be canceled. SpaceX will keep trying. On this 10th flight, they're hoping to break a streak of mishaps this year. 3 flights in a row with the upper stage lost instead of returning to Earth in a controlled way. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Stocks are trading mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 9 points. The Nasdaq Composite up 7. The S&P up a point. This is NPR News. Friday marks 20 years since Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans. Eva Tesfaye from member station WWNO reports community groups are commemorating the anniversary this week with performances, music, and art.
The Katrina 20 week of action includes dozens of events remembering Hurricane Katrina, including a performance of the play Swimming Upstream, the Katrina Monologues, and an art exhibition about New Orleans culture across the country called Katrina, a Neo-Diaspora. Asali Devon Ecclesiastes is the executive director of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center in New Orleans.
So many things that happened around Katrina 10 we didn't want to happen around Katrina 20. Most importantly being that the voices of the people who actually experienced Katrina were not censored.
These commemorations stretch beyond New Orleans to Alabama and Mississippi, where people were also affected by the storm. For NPR News, I'm Eva Tesfaye in New Orleans.
Tech billionaire Elon Musk has filed a lawsuit against Apple and OpenAI. He's accusing the companies of teaming up to reduce competition in artificial intelligence. The crux of the lawsuit revolves around Apple's decision to use ChatGPT as an AI-powered answer engine on the iPhone when the built-in technology on its device couldn't satisfy user needs. In a counter lawsuit, OpenAI has accused Musk of harassment. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We're turning now to the Pennsylvania state budget. Wayne and Pike counties haven't yet felt the pinch from delayed state funding, but local leaders are keeping a close eye on the situation. Joining us live is River Reporter news editor Liam Mayo, who's been tracking the budget impasse in Pennsylvania and the effects and potential effects in Northeast Pennsylvania. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Can you summarize for folks the current status of the Pennsylvania state budget and why it hasn't been approved yet?
So the Pennsylvania state budget has a legal deadline of end of June, early July. And given that it's almost September now, that budget or that deadline has very clearly come and gone, and Pennsylvania does not yet have a finalized budget. One of the impacts of that is that payments that would be made to local and regional agencies from the state are now not going through. The budget is what authorizes the state to sort of spend the money that it has. And without a budget agreement in place, the state can't send out any of that money. And in previous years, there have been more sort of temporary agreements to let the state continue to pay the money that had already been allocated while the overall terms of the budget are getting negotiated, but there is not that agreement in place this year. And as for why that's still sort of not there, Spotlight PA has been following this really closely, and they've and according to them, the hang-up really is around transit funding. Both Republicans and Democrats want to increase the amount of funding that goes to public transit in Pennsylvania, but there's sort of disagreements on where that funding could come from. The Democratic-controlled House proposed increasing the amount of general sales tax that goes to Pennsylvania's public transit. The Republicans have pulled back on that a little bit because Pennsylvania runs a structural deficit, and putting any kind of like general tax fund money to that specific use would then create a hole in the budget that doesn't really have another good way of getting filled. Republicans have countered with the idea of using money that's kind of already there in a specific transit fund to bolster funding to general transit stuff. But Democrats don't like that idea very much because that money in that specific transit fund is for longer term capital projects. It's not for general, like, day to day operations. So either way you cut it, that's leaving a hole in the budget somewhere. And there's still this disagreement on where that hole should be.
So the state legislature missed that end of June deadline. They're trying to hash it all out. How is this impacting folks locally in Northeast Pennsylvania? You spoke to some area leaders in Wayne and Pike counties. Are they feeling anything yet?
So far, we're not hearing any major impacts in Wayne and Pike counties. There were a couple that we heard, according to Pike County Commissioner Matt Osterberg. There was some worry that the Carbon Monroe Pike Drug and Alcohol Commission could not be able to provide its services, but the county was able to flex some opioid settlement fund money to make sure that happens. He also said that he's heard child care providers may be more impacted than this by some like bigger state or regional agencies. But in general, the people we talked to said that they either haven't sort of felt these missed payments yet, or they have enough money in reserve to weather a couple of missed payments or both. We talked to Wallenpaupack Area School District Superintendent Keith Ganeski, who said that the district has not been negatively affected at this time, and that with local property taxes already having been collected, or those funds should see the district through the delay in state funding. We also talked to Michelle Young, the director of the Wayne County Family Center, which provides kind of early childhood care for children. She said that in the past, there have been family centers around the state that have had to either close or reduce their services due to budget delays, but she doesn't anticipate, or she said that Wayne County Family Center has never been among them and does not anticipate that being the case this time around either. However, she did say, quote, regardless, I'll rest easier when the budget is passed and funding is released for all the schools and vital programs that need this money. So people are concerned about what could happen if this disagreement continues and if the budget is continually delayed and if there are more missed payments, say, going into September. But people aren't generally feeling that impact as of this moment in time.
Are there any preventative measures being taken by county leaders to prepare for such a prolonged budget impasse?
Yeah. In Wayne County, Wayne County Clerk Andrew Sater told us that the county has put its department heads on notice that there is an issue with the state budget, but it hasn't yet asked department heads to cut any services. He did say that if the budget impasse goes on a couple more weeks, the county will have to talk about what steps it could take to weather the storm. So I think everybody is looking at this and everybody is preparing to potentially make some changes in services or preparing to shift some money around to make sure that services are not disrupted. But as of right now, they're still looking at, okay, we may need to do this in a couple of weeks, not we are needing to do this on a large scale at this moment in time.
And have you heard from local leaders about how they're attributing this delay? Is it solely to political disagreements, or are there other factors at play?
Yeah, we heard from the Pike County Commissioner, Matt Osterberg, that this is basically politics and that he thinks it's a shame that political disagreements can cause such havoc on the local level. He said, quote, this is always disruptive to an entire community when they do this. So even though, you know, people might not be feeling direct immediate impacts, just the idea that this is something people need to prepare for is something that's weighing on people's minds in a way that it wouldn't necessarily need to if politicians at the state level could find more easy agreement.
And what else are you hearing from your partners at Spotlight PA and their reporting about the progress of this? Is there any, bright signs of, some negotiations here, or is it still just stuck?
Yeah, there was a hint of an agreement actually this week, or a hint of a little bit of progress. Spotlight has an article out called Shapiro Open to Using Special Transit Funding to Combat Public Transit Cuts as Part of a Broader Package. And the article says basically what it says on the tin, which is that while Democrats were sort of initially very strongly opposed to using that special like capital fund transit money to fund public transit, on this Monday, so yesterday, Shapiro said that he was willing to do that as long as it was part of this broader package. However, there's another sort of part to that disagreement that is still up in the air. Republicans have focused on making sure that any kind of deal brings dollars to road work and sort of that side of infrastructure funding, whereas Democrats have focused more on kind of like public transit, not just, you know, like buses and trains, but also things like medical, like shared ride programs, which is the kind of public transit I think is more common in our area. And Shapiro, while he did say that he was willing to flex some of that capital funding project or capital funding money to general funding for mass transit, he said that he would not support a deal that diverted those transit dollars to roads. So that part of the disagreement is still very much there. And there has not been, like, I guess, meaningful legislative process over the past couple of weeks. Both sides have, early in August, I believe, presented their different visions of what a deal could look like as legislation, but neither side has found agreement with that yet.
Yeah, it looks like they weren't planning to be in session this month anyway. And Shapiro pointing fingers at the state Senate saying they haven't been holding enough voting sessions in Harrisburg. But he's also been saying at the same time over recent weeks that there's a budget deal that's close. So lots of pointing of fingers there back and forth over the budget issue and a real pain for local communities.
Yeah. And just to bring in sort of another local legislator's voice, one of the state senators for the Wayne Pike area is Senator Lisa Baker. And in talking about sort of the Senate's proposal, she said that their plan, which, you know, she's talking about the fact that the Republican proposals would divert money to roadwork and bridge infrastructure. The press release she put out said that their plan recognizes the need for mass transit funding, but not at the expense of the rest of the Commonwealth. The plan turns a necessary corner in the right direction by prioritizing equity in funding, ensuring small communities in rural areas also receive resources. So there's the idea that, prioritizing road work over sort of public transportation would help rural areas more, given that public transportation in rural areas is kind of less common or less strong. But there are sort of still public transportation programs that would fall into that mass transit category. I believe that the medical transportation, like shared ride type programs, do fall into that category of mass transportation. And that is something that would operate in the Wayne Pike area.
That's Liam Mayo, news editor of the River Reporter, reporting on the Pennsylvania budget delay and how it's impacting local communities in Wayne and Pike counties. For the most part, they haven't needed to cut any services due to the delayed budget, but they're keeping an eye on it in case this delay continues much longer. And then we know that Liam will keep an eye on it, too. You can read his reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Karen Russell steps up as CEO of New Hope Community, tackling tough challenges and redefining disability culture. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm co-star Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Chatskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me, the Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York, grizzlybagels.com, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. After 3 decades with New Hope Community, Karen Russell has been named its new CEO. Known for her deep commitment to the organization and the community it serves, Russell steps into the role amid growing challenges, including cuts to medical services and hospitals. In an interview with Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett, Russell discussed her history with New Hope, her vision as CEO, and why society needs to rethink how it views people with disabilities.
you joined the New Hope community in about 30 years ago in 1995. Can you talk about your professional journey up until that point and what really drew you to New Hope community?
I started here in 1995. I was new to the area, new to Sullivan County. And when I came to New Hope Community, everything was so new and so different to me. I grew up on Long Island and had started my career down there and a few other places upstate after school. And I was learning so much about this new area. And I was intrigued by New Hope Community. I came here for an interview, and I tell every orientation class here the same story, that I intended to stay at New Hope for 1 year. Well, I learned all about my new surroundings, and I became so connected to the organization and just so much believed in what we did and what our staff did that I never left. And I stayed here for the 30 years. I started as a service coordinator, helping people and their families access services. And I continued to move up through the ranks here at New Hope. I got a couple of master's degrees along the way, which helped me in my journey. And I had a lot of opportunities here. I moved into the quality assurance and compliance fields, started those departments, developed a lot of those resources for the organization, and then just continued on into different executive positions, overseeing healthcare, overseeing behavioral services, overseeing our residential services, until the most recent position was as chief operating officer. And I spent the last 4 or 5 years in that position. And then when it was time for a new CEO to move into New Hope Community, I just felt that I just still so strongly believed in our staff and our mission that it was the right time for me to continue to lead the organization from the front.
And for any listeners who may not be aware, what is New Hope Community? What's your mission?
So New Hope Community, we're celebrating our 50-year anniversary this year. We started in 1975 in what was once an old hotel in Sullivan County with a few individuals and a few families that were supporting us. We support people who have intellectual and developmental disabilities, and we provide residential supports to those individuals. We have a little less than 40 houses throughout the community, some on our main campus in Loch Sheldrake for people who are a little bit more medically frail, and some through scattered throughout Sullivan County as a whole, where our homes are fully staffed and fully supported. And the individuals that live in those homes, we just help them live their life. And then we also donate to all of the local food banks in Sullivan County as well. So many hands in one farm and in one place that are all coming together to support each other and support the community. And that to me is just a really beautiful thing.
We're seeing cuts to hospitals happening right now, obviously to Medicare. How much does that impact the New Hope community? And how are you as a CEO going to take that on?
We are all watching the impacts on the healthcare system as a whole, because we all rely upon all of our local resources so much, our hospitals, our physicians, our local providers. They're so important to our staff and to the individuals that we support and to the community at large. So we're all being really vigilant about what's going to happen with some of these cuts that are proposed, and especially the impacts that these cuts can have upon our staff members. Our staff are incredibly important to us. The work that they do is just phenomenal. They do it with their heart. They do it with skill. They believe in the work that they do, but they have to be able to live in our community, and they have to be able to afford to live in our community. So they need that medical care and the access to medical care, the access to transportation, the livable wage that we fight so hard for them to be able to receive. So it's going to be important that we protect the resources that we have, that we gear up for any cuts that actually do finally go through, what gets passed down from the federal share down to the state share, and how we're going to manage that.
Just on a social level, what do you feel like is still one of the major misconceptions in our culture about people who have disabilities? What do you feel like is really people just don't understand or get wrong?
When people hear that somebody has a disability, they immediately negate the fact that they have so many other abilities, that they have so much skill, so much to offer. We have a supported work program here at New Hope Community where we help people learn job skills. We help them either on individual placements or working as part of a team. And many of our individuals are working at employers in the community. Just because somebody might have a disability does not mean that they don't have a vocational skill to offer and that they're not going to be a fantastic employee and a fantastic team member.
You've come through the organization. What have you learned, and what do you want to bring in your leadership?
I think it's extremely important that we have career paths for our staff members, that people come into the organization, that they're not just getting a job. We have opportunities for you to develop your career. So many people that have been here, myself included, I was able to develop along the way, but come in as a direct support professional and you know what? We'll help you with tuition reimbursement. We'll help you go to school, become an RN and then be employed here as an RN. Or move into residential leadership. But I really want to see people see how much career opportunities that are here and how much assistance New Hope Community will provide for you to do that. And then in turn, how we can help you and your family really establish yourself both in the organization and in years to come. I'm looking forward to growth and technology supports. We are focused very much on that right now, both for the autism community and for other people with disabilities. We have multiple grants that we're working with that's going to provide us the opportunities to do that. I want to continue the community collaboration that we have already been working on over the years, and I would like to increase that. I want more people coming into our community here and us continuing to work with people in the community and all of us leveraging our resources together, because I think that supports the community at large.
Is there anything else that you would like to talk about that you're excited about or any issue that's really important to you as you start your time as CEO?
I am so greatly appreciative of the opportunity to be in the CEO position. I would welcome anybody who has any questions about New Hope Community or would like to come and visit us and learn about us to please reach out to us. We are always open to sharing who we are and our resources with the community for anything that they would like to collaborate on or just learn about us. We are here and we do fantastic work, if I do say so myself. It is what has kept me here all of these years. It's just a place I very much believe in, and I'm excited for our future.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest episode of Cats Cast. After 10 years at the Catskill Center, Jeff Centerman and Callie Finkelstein look back on a decade of growth, community engagement, and landmark wins, like securing a dedicated state budget for the Catskills and the Catskill Park. We'll hear from them next. This is Radio Chatskill.
This is Latif Nasser from Radiolab. Public media organizations across the country lost our federal funding. This cut will have long-term consequences for the service we provide to you, our community, unless we are able to replace that funding with support from more of our listeners. The future of public media is in your hands. Go to this station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Radio Catskill's Music Yard Sale returns this Saturday with vinyl records, CDs, record players, and more for sale, all donated by listeners like you. Got something musical in decent condition? Need to downsize? Get your record collection into good hands for a great cause. Email feedback at wjffradio.org to donate. That's feedback at wjffradio.org. And you can still come to the sale this Saturday, 10 to 3 at Radio Catskill in Liberty.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Catskill Center's addition of 3.6 acres to its Platte Clove Preserve may not sound like much, but its potential impact on the Catskills landscape is outsized. In the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, host Brett Berry joins Jeff Centerman and Callie Bird, her correct last name that I mispronounced or missaid earlier, Callie Bird of the Catskill Center, to explore the newly acquired parcel at the top of Platte Clove, a critical piece of wilderness that protects public access, scenic views, and ecological integrity. Brett Berry is joining us now with a preview. Brett, hello.
Hello, good morning, Tim.
Jeff and Callie have been with the Catskill Center for a decade, as we mentioned, overseeing these major shifts in the organization's role and reach. Can you share a little bit about how their leadership helped secure this dedicated state budget line and how that's such a game changer for them and the Catskill Center?
Yeah, that's one of the big things that came out of the interview. When they joined the Catskill Center 10 years ago, The Catskills didn't have its own budget line in the New York State budget, so there was always a fight for resources. I think there's still clamoring for resources, but now that there's actually a line for the Catskills in the state budget, thanks in large part to the advocacy of the Catskill Center over the past 10 years, that can't be taken away easily. So there's always a good pot of money for both the Catskills and the Adirondacks. And the Adirondacks was kind of getting more attention in the past.
The Artist Cabin and community engagement have been central to the center's mission. How have their 10 years of leadership shaped the way the Catskill Center balances protecting wildlands with supporting these local communities?
Yeah. So the Catskill Center is an organization that protects not just the natural resources of the Catskills, but also the cultural resources and business interests, and tries to find a balance by working with lots of different partners to make the Catskills or keep the Catskills what it is, which is a really interesting mix of public lands and private lands, and a place that people can come and visit and explore in a kind of a different way than going to a dedicated park that's just park. This new acquisition of just 3.6 acres, but it's an important one, helps with that balance and access to some really interesting trails and natural resources at the head of Platte Clove.
All right, let's listen to an excerpt of the latest episode of Cat's Cast with Brett Berry. He's speaking to Jeff Centerman and Callie Bird, reflecting on a decade at the Catskill Center and securing that funding from the state, deepening community connections, and sharing how their work is shaping the future of the Catskills. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you, Tim.
A couple weeks ago, we reported on the Open Space Institute's acquisition of 3,100 acres in the Southwest Catskills. Today, we're focusing on a newly protected parcel that's just 3.6 acres, but it's a critical piece in a treasured clove. To learn more, I met up with the Catskill Center's Jeff Centerman and Kelly Bird at the Platte Clove Preserve in the town of Hunter.
I am Jeff Centerman. I'm the executive director of the Catskill Center, and we are at the Catskill Center's Platte Clove Preserve at the top of Platte Clove in the town of Hunter.
And I'm Callie Bird. I'm the deputy executive director of the Catskill Center.
And this house that we're at, this little rustic cabin on the side of the road, is has some history of its own. Can you tell me what that is in relation to the Catskill Center, or even maybe before?
We call it the Artist Cabin. It's also been known as the Little Red Cabin for anybody that drives Platte Clove Road and goes by. It has been part of the preserve since the Catskill Center acquired the lands back in the 1970s. It's been used in a number of different ways over the years. Most recently, for about 20 years, it was home to the Catskill Center's Artist in Residence program. That program has winded down, and now we are looking to preserve and protect this cabin, keep it up, and look at new ways that we can use it to engage with the public and help interpret the Platte Clove Preserve for the public.
What's the history of this property, and how did the Catskill Center come to be its steward?
So Platte Clove has been sort of a destination for a very long time for folks coming to the Catskills. The property before the Catskill Center was owned by the Griswold family. And then there was the Kukli family that also has property nearby. And the Kuklis spoke with the Griswolds about the importance of this property, about the historical significance of the area. This was all during the 1970s, and convinced the Griswold family to donate about 206 acres of land to the Catskill Center. So there's 100 acres of the preserve south of Platte Clove Road and about 100 acres north of Platte Clove Road now. So we have a number of different trails here on the preserve. There's the Overlook Trail. We have the trail to the waterfall. And then on the other side of Platte Clove Road, on the north side, the trail up to Huckleberry Point traverses our property. And the really cool thing about the Platte Cove Preserve is that it's surrounded probably by about 90% state land. And so the Platte Cove Preserve on both sides of Platte Cove Road are really kind of the entryways to significant wild forest and wilderness areas. So to the south is the Indian Head Wilderness Area, which is tens of thousands of acres of wilderness area across the Devil's Path Range. And to our north is the Catterskill Wild Forest, which immediately to the north is Catterskill High Peak and Round Top Mountains. And so really to access any of those lands and all of the trails that are on that forest preserve, folks have to begin here at the trailhead on Platte Cove Road and come through the Platte Cove Preserve. So it's an awesome opportunity for us at the Catskill Center to kind of welcome people to the Catskill, center them in the Catskill Park, and have them understand what the Catskill Center is doing here.
What is the Catskill Center doing here? For those who don't know, can you both maybe give me a little overview of the relationship between the Catskill Center and the Catskills and how you interface with the public and the programs from a very kind of bird's eye view?
The Catskill Center was founded in 1969 in order to preserve, protect, and enrich the environmental, cultural, and economic resources of the Catskills. Now, that's a really wide-ranging mission, and I joke when people ask me what you do with that. It basically means that the Catskill Center can work kind of in all areas across the Catskills. And we have done it in many different ways in the 56 years of history that we have here in the Catskills. Our real big goal for all of our work, I think, through all of that time has been to show that both natural places and communities can coexist and really need each other. You know, one of the reasons why the Catskills is so special is because we have such amazing protected wild areas. And within that is nestled vibrant communities. And so people are not only coming to the Catskills like in a traditional park sense where you go to a park to just recreate and, you know, you have that experience, or the park protects one certain resource. The Catskill Park is both those incredible wild areas, but it's also those incredible communities. And so all of our work throughout time has been to protect as much as possible across the Catskills. We've, over that history, protected tens of thousands of acres of land that have been transferred to New York State. Other properties like this Platte Cove Preserve we have kept as our own preserves. That's been our driving force, is how do we protect the Catskills, but protect them holistically as opposed to simply focusing on, you know, just protecting natural resources.
And also conservation easements on lands that you don't own, right?
Correct. We hold about 2,000 acres of conservation easements on other folks' property throughout the Catskills that help protect those properties from further development.
So the Catskill Center just acquired 3.6 acres, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's an important parcel that is added to the Platte Cove Preserve. Tell me a little bit about this property. How did it come up for sale, or was there an effort to acquire it? And why is it so important to add it to what you have here?
So those 3.6 acres, like you said, it doesn't sound like very much land, but it is the last undeveloped parcel here at the top of Platte Cove. So the other properties is there is an existing home that is privately owned, but then the rest of the property surrounding the top of Platte Cove is all in public hands or in the hands of the Catskill Center. And so when a for sale sign went up on that property, we were concerned at the Catskill Center, and the community was concerned, the town, the state, everybody was concerned. But as I think everybody who has ever looked at real estate in the Catskills knows, the real estate market can be challenging. And so, you know, at first when we looked into it, it was beyond the means of the Catskill Center to move quickly and to make a purchase. The Catskill Center is a nonprofit organization without unlimited resources. And so therefore, we had a conversation with the private owner at the time, but weren't able to make an offer. We had a lot of conversations with lots of people, and we had a donor that stepped forward and was willing to help the Catskill Center as long as we also included some of our own funding, and entered into a conversation with that private owner of the property. And we were able to secure that 3.6 acres for about $300,000.
Kelly, tell me a little bit about your relationship to this property.
Sure. This is a beautiful property with a lot of native habitat, plants, animals, really important breeding habitat for our interior forest birds. It's also a really critical access for people to be able to get out into some of the more wilderness and very rugged areas of the Catskills, which are so special and so important for so many people. And adding this parcel of land helps improve the safety of that access, which is also important for our local communities, as it is an extremely popular destination. Adding this piece will help improve that opportunity, as well as helping to continue to protect the integrity, the ecological integrity of this land. Anytime people are building anything, especially new homes, there's usually fill that comes in. There's usually more invasive plants that come in, not intentionally, but seeds will come in with the dirt. It'll come in on equipment, et cetera. And so by not having a new building at the top of a clove, it also means we will not have that new source of invasive plant seeds coming in at the top of a clove to filter down and trickle down with the waterways to the bottom and all along through. So it really does just help to protect the ecological integrity of this whole landscape. This is our first property that we have acquired in fee since I joined, I believe, 10 years ago, joined the Catskill Center. So we don't acquire properties very often. So it's actually a kind of a big deal for us, not just acquiring this particular property, but any property, really, in fee for the Catskill Center.
And you just created a really nice segue for me. You mentioned that this is the first acquisition since you've been with the Catskill Center 10 years. And this year marks both of your 10-year anniversaries with the Catskill Center. So congratulations. I guess reflect a little bit for me on those 10 years and some of your proudest accomplishments or what it's like to be a part of this organization.
I would say it's been a whirlwind in so many ways. 10 years is a long time for any particular thing. So over this 10 years of time at the Catskill Center, when I first started, we had about 6 staff and a $600,000 budget. And more recently, we've had about 24 full-time equivalent staff and a nearly $3 million budget, $2.5 million budget. So it's been a lot of growth, but also lots of challenges with that, both in terms of just growth, but moving from one place to another place as an organization. Jeff and I inherited one organization and with a certain sort of culture and background, and we've really brought it to not a different organization, but just a new place. I mean, 10 years out of a 56 is kind of a significant amount, in terms of just the experience, life and accomplishments of an organization. And so I think in terms of proudest accomplishments, honestly, I think I feel like we have a better foundation from a governance structures for collaboration, for advocacy, where I think we are a more equipped partner for achieving great things in the Catskills now than we were 10 years ago. You know, I think when we inherited the organization on some level, the leadership of the organization, there were some really big dreams and some like really significant accomplishments that had recently occurred. We had just opened the visitor center, the Catskills Visitor Center, quite recently. And there was a lot of vision for the future. And so spending 10 years sort of helping to build that has been, exciting and tiring.
Jeff, do you have similar sentiments?
Everything that Callie said, my first day at the Catskill Center was actually the day that the Catskills Visitor Center opened. And I think it really represents a new direction for the Catskill Center. Prior to the 20-teens, the Catskill Center was a quiet organization for many reasons, and it did a lot of great work, but it did it kind of behind the scenes, and a lot of folks had no idea that there was a Catskill Center and that it was doing the work that it did. And shortly before I arrived and Callie arrived, that really started changing. The Catskill Center accepted the partnership with New York State to operate the Catskills Visitor Center together, which really just put the Catskill Center front and center of, like, we are going to be the organization that represents the Catskill Park and the Catskills. We also started embarking on understanding, advocacy, and education in Albany of our lawmakers. And that had started just before I arrived. I was actually involved with it in my prior job at the New York New Jersey Trail Conference with the Catskill Center, of just establishing a group of organizations and folks who would go to Albany and be a squeaky wheel. For me, what I'm most proud of is really bringing attention in Albany to the Catskill Park. You know, for decades, the joke was always the DEC commissioner's chair pointed north to the Adirondacks. And pretty much no one else in Albany, from the governor and the legislature on down, never really even thought about the Catskill Park. You know, within a few years of us starting our advocacy effort, we created the Catskill Park Coalition, which is several dozen organizations that are all dedicated to the protection of the Catskill Park and bringing more resources. We started getting attention almost immediately. We started appearing in maybe the Senate proposed some funding for the Catskills. It didn't make it to the final budget, but like we were getting there. We formed a coalition with other organizations and communities from the Adirondacks. So we now have not only the Catskill Park Coalition, but the Forest Preserve Coalition. All of that has led in the last 3 years to more than $26 million of funding being brought to the Catskills and to the Adirondacks. This will be the fourth budget year that the two parks actually have a budget item in the state budget, which, you know, some folks may be like, well, what's the big deal? The big deal is that once you get named in the New York State budget, it's really hard to take you out of the New York State budget. And so now, instead of agencies like the DEC trying to pull bits and pieces of money from different places, they have a line that says, this money you must spend in the Catskills. We've also increased funding for programs like the Catskill Science Collaborative at the Carey Institute for Ecosystem Studies, doing good work across the Catskills in terms of science research. We've gotten funding for the Catskills Visitor Center in the state budget. We've maintained the funding for the Bel Air Ski Center. And we've just raised the awareness of the challenges that the Catskill Park and the Adirondack Park really, as being these unique forest preserve parks, which are a mix of state and private lands, face, and that the resources that they need. So to me, the fact that we are bringing millions of dollars that didn't exist 10 years ago into the Catskills is really our greatest accomplishment.
So the Catskills have experienced quite a surge in visitors and land use. Are we keeping up with that in terms of preservation, access, increased funding? Where do you see that going?
My one-word answer would be no. New York is one of the lucky places where we continue to invest in our wild spaces. You know, we see the federal government retreating from a lot of investment and perhaps even divestment of public lands, which is just a really scary thought. But for us here in New York has protected a lot of land and continues to protect land. And for the last decade or so, we have seen that investment ramp up in all of our public lands here in New York. But, you know, we have so much to catch up on in terms of anyone who's hiked a trail in the Catskills knows that many of our trails are eroded. Anyone who's tried to park in a parking lot for a popular trail knows that they're very undersized for the use that we see. If anyone has visited Catterskill Falls, you know that it's a little crazy to go there on even a weekday nowadays to get to see the falls. And so there's just a lot that needs to be done and needs to be thought of and needs to be implemented across the park in terms of steady increasing funding, staffing, resources for everyone from the agencies to organizations like the Catskill Center to towns like the town of Hunter to be able to address that increasing recreational use that we're seeing. Recreational use is awesome for the Catskill Park. Like, people are coming here because this place is awesome and it's an amazing natural place. But we need to do the hard work to ensure that what I see today on my explorations of the Catskill Park are what the next generation sees, or that they see something even better than I'm seeing, because in many cases we can do better. You know, we just need to ensure that we continue funding and doing that work to address that increasing use.
From the Platte Clove Preserve in the town of Hunter in Greene County, this is Brett Barry for WJFF Radio Catskill.
And you can hear the full episode of Cat's Cast at the website catscast.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, one of the most visionary voices in music today, Phoebe Legere, joins us next to talk about her latest project debuting at the Phoenicia Playhouse. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
This week in This American Life, when Angela's family goes on vacation, her dad plans everything. One year, the plan went awry.
I don't think I was particularly traumatized.
Wow, you went, like, you got hit by lightning.
Like, lightning's not personal. The lightning wasn't like, Angela, you're ugly.
When nature, fate, and the federal government mess with your plans, that's this week.
Tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. She's been called everything from Beethoven to Edith Piaf, and now visionary singer, composer, and multi-instrumentalist Phoebe Legere is back with a brand new film premiering August 31st at the Phoenicia Playhouse, and her new single is Two Pianos, a haunting new ballad. It dropped last week. Here's a little bit of that.
The piano is all alone, and I'm alone at the piano. The notes are lying side by side.
Phoebe Legere joins us now to talk about the premiere of the film, the story behind her latest work, and why her art is always more than just about music. Phoebe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim. I'm thrilled.
Let's talk about the brand new film premiering at Phoenicia Playhouse on the 31st. Your work blends languages, genres, even art forms. How does this film expand on the cross-disciplinary approach that you're known for?
Great question. I was the director of the film. I'm in the film. I designed all of the costumes from junk that I found floating in the canals of Venice. I always use upcycled and repurposed sustainable materials to do all of my art. I also did the animation for the film. It's called The Gender Symphony, and it is about a man and a woman suddenly, magically switching places. Men and women are so fascinated with each other and the differences between us and the incredible, fundamental, universal human similarities between men and women are so, it is the basis of almost all of art and music. And of course, it is the engine for love, the greatest of human activities, Tim.
You've called your style eco-magic. How can you describe how audience will see or hear that come alive on the screen and at this premiere?
Thank you. The theme song of the movie is the song that you just played a little bit of. Thank you. It's called Two Pianos. And it is about climate chaos and about rising sea levels. And the idea came to me because I found out that when the Titanic tragedy, the great shipwreck occurred, the two Bösendorfer, those are big, beautiful, expensive, shiny black pianos, the two pianos floated out of the windows of the Titanic ballroom. And when the rescuers came, they saw, as you know, the rescuers came an hour and a half after the ship went down. There was no ship. All they saw were beautiful icebergs, 3,000 dead bodies floating, and the two Bösendorfer pianos dancing amid the death and the icebergs. Mm. And so this, to me, became a metaphor for the way that art persists in the greatest tragedy, in the greatest confusion. Art does not die. It seems to exist in a kind of a liminal space between life and death. There's something very spiritual about art. And so this piano is all about that moment.
You talked about the environmental impact as well and social upheaval, this world facing so much of that going on. What do you see as an artist's responsibility in terms of delivering messages to the public about that?
Well, you know, Tim, we are living in an extraordinary political moment, but I don't believe in despair. What I believe in is creativity. And I believe that we can sing our way forward together. And so this is why my song is about the climate crisis, but it is also about love, love for our children and love for the earth that they are going to inherit.
You play seven instruments, including one of your own inventions. Talk to us about, if I say this correctly, Sneakers of the Sabbath Race?
Yes. I have another job that I do in addition to being an artist, which is that I am the executive director of the Foundation for New American Art, a nonprofit that brings art and music after school, summers and Saturdays, free art and music to the children of low-income communities. We work in Poughkeepsie and in the five boroughs of New York City. And so I have a deep connection to children. I love them. I think they're all geniuses. They feed me. They give me this incredible joy. And I have worked for many years with children and with disabled children. So when I was working at the Rusk Institute as a volunteer, bringing free music classes to kids who had terrible, afflictive children with disabilities, I met children that could not walk or that had recently had a leg amputated. And I developed a form of shoes that would inspire them to take the difficult next step. So these are sneakers that play music by a simple movement of the foot, a tiny movement, and the sneakers generate a rhythm. So I began to use these in my own work, and you hear them on this track, two pianos. The synthesizers are the Sneakers of Samothrace. Mm-hmm.
And those children are really fueling your creativity as well as benefiting through the foundation. After this Venetia debut for the film, where do you see the project going? Are you bringing it to other places, touring? What's next?
I am touring. I will be touring the Hudson Valley area. As I said, I work in Poughkeepsie. I work with children in Poughkeepsie right on Main Street, one of the most embattled and vulnerable neighborhoods, if you know downtown Poughkeepsie, but filled with the most wonderful people. And so I will be touring with my music and with my film. My film is already going around the world. We've won 19 prizes. And my song, Two Pianos, that I wrote the words and music and play all the instruments on it. And it is being added to impactful Spotify playlists. And we're getting lots of ads. It's in French and English. So we're getting lots of ads in France, Haiti, Belgium, and Quebec. So I'll be touring to support my record and to just bring the message that creativity and kindness are the most radical form of power.
That's a good message. That's Phoebe Legere sharing the story behind her new film, The Gender Symphony, premiering Sunday, August 31st at the Phoenicia Playhouse. For details, visit PhoeniciaPlayhouse.com or PhoebeLegere.com. And Phoebe will go out with a little bit more of Two Pianos. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.
Art music never dies. Dans tous les naufrages, les pianos flottent toujours. Du piano, danse-t-on en dos, dans une salle de bain immense.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hello, I'm Tom Candela, host of Curtain Call, where I spotlight the magic of theater one conversation at a time. This week, playwright Douglas Carter Bean, the Tony-nominated author of Little Dog Laugh, Xanadu, and Cinderella, joins me to talk about his new show, Finding Dorothy Parker. It's a theatrical celebration you won't want to miss. Full episode drops this Friday on the Curtain Call podcast at WJFFradio.org, only from Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather partly sunny with a thunder shower in spots this afternoon. Some gusty winds and small hail could accompany any heavy downpour. High only 68, tonight's low 49. Tomorrow, an AM shower, mostly sunny though, high 65. It's 11.